From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 157, where I am joined by extraordinary woman Kelly Canuetto. Kelly is a 49-year-old Brit living in Marbella, Spain. She began suffering with chronic pain after a whiplash injury which never seemed to heal. After years of neck and back pain, she later went on to develop fibromyalgia, a condition that caused severe widespread pain and extreme fatigue, never alleviated by rest. As you will soon discover, Kelly also happens to be one of my oldest friends. We met as young teenagers when I changed schools and almost instantly became best buddies. Although we took different paths just a few years later when we changed schools for the sixth form, we have always stayed in touch and remained close friends. That sort of friendship is unique, I think, and I am so happy and privileged to get to share her story with you today. Probably not surprisingly, we ran long, so this is the first of two episodes. It's a little different from the usual, as it has nothing to do with keto, although you will hear how she tried a few different dietary approaches along her rather torturous path to recovery. This is instead the story of how she won her battle against fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. I have been nagging her to come on the podcast since the beginning, pretty much, but the time was right after she shared her story in KKB and it had an immediate and positive impact for women in the group. If you think any of what she shares sounds familiar to you and your struggles, then I hope this becomes the starting point for you too to finally start getting some answers and planning your own recovery. The show notes are jam-packed with resources, and I will also be adding other people's stories as I get them and the things that they found helpful. I'll keep adding as time goes on, so do please check these out as a great hub of information. The link will be in the description on your podcatcher, but you can also simply go directly to the page, which will be at ketowomanpodcast.com/157 and also 158 from next week. If you have something to share that has helped you and want to add to the show notes or come on the podcast as a guest yourself to share your story, then feel free to reach out to me on social media or by email at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you. I do need to warn you before we get started, there's an F-bomb. I'm really anti-censoring or bleeping, but appreciate that you might not want to be blindsided by it, so here is your advance warning. I think there is also the odd lower grade swear in there too. Okay, with that done, and with a reminder that neither Kelly nor I are medical or psych professionals, we're just two gals from the UK getting together to share an inspiring story with you. Let's jump in. Welcome, Kelly, to the Keto Women podcast. How are you doing today?
Hi, Daisy. Lovely to talk to you.
Well, this is a rather unique episode in the light of the fact that we have known each other for a very, very long time. What is it? It's got to be. Ooh. I was working out. I reckon it's 37 years. I think we met when we were 13.
I was going to say the same, 37 years. Good God. Where did that go?
I know. Long time. We're the same age, so we're both not going to be 50 this year. We're saving it for next year.
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely put being 50 on hold till 2021.
Yeah, exactly.
Not in a rush to get to that milestone.
No, I'm quite happy to put it off for a year. I was thinking about it when we first started talking about recording. I was thinking about how unique friendships are that go back that far, because you can't replicate them. It's impossible. You can't replicate a friendship you've had where you've grown up with somebody. You just can't get that with friendships you make when you're already a grown up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like when you're a teenager, you're so vulnerable, like you're really sharing so much of like what's going on in your life as you develop. And of course, you have such a familiarity with the idiosyncrasies of each other's families and just such a shared history. But although we've lived in different countries for 16 years,
17 I've been here,
and there's been years when perhaps we didn't chat so much, thankfully now talking is free to anybody anywhere in the world pretty much. It's really kind of been a massive like blessing to like be able to have you back in my life in a much more kind of daily capacity. So yeah, I think it's like, it's just been so great to rekindle our friendship. And you are always my favorite person to talk to because you make me laugh like nobody else.
I think that's the thing. Again, I was thinking about it actually. Especially in the span of that 37 years, we were in each other's pockets for relatively a short period of time, probably 3 years, before we went our separate ways. We changed schools in the sixth form and had quite different lives, really. But I was reflecting on it.
Yeah, you went up to Liverpool University and yeah. I was in North London.
I think that's part of what kept us together, actually, that we had quite different lives, but that our core values and sense of humour especially are so similar that we have that kind of that bedrock. But the fact that we're quite different in a lot of ways has helped sustain it.
Yeah, I think a shared like a connection like with the sense of humour is something which is like really unique to two people. So when you find somebody who really gets you, who can make you like cry with laughter, it's a friendship to treasure and keep hold of.
You talk about teenage girls being vulnerable, and there is a vulnerability and there is that sharing. I think with women in general share so much more than men do. But again, I was thinking about it the other day and how in many ways I'm glad that I haven't got children, and in particular teenage girls, because you go back and you remember how we thought we were invincible. There's some kind of bulletproofness to the way you think you are when you're a teenager. And I was just thinking about some of the scrapes we used to get into. And I thought, I would not want to be your parents.
But I think your inexperience at that age is what makes you feel invincible. You've not experienced fear, so you are fearless. You've not really found where that hard edge is. So we were definitely pushing the boundaries and getting into some interesting situations.
Yeah, we definitely have the dirt on each other, put it.
But I'm also like really thankful not to be a teenager in today's world where every single thing you do is recorded.
Oh, goodness.
And, you know, shared with the world.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine if some of the things we did had been out there on social media? It'd be hellish to be reliving those.
It was bad enough when the headmistress just caught us passing notes.
Oh, goodness me. Yes, those were the days in many ways. But
yeah, we've become very nice, responsible adults, even though we were kind of pretty cheeky teenage girls.
Yeah, we were pretty naughty, weren't we? Certainly, as you say, we pushed the boundaries a bit with school, with parents.
I think it's, you know, naughty children quite often are bored children.
True.
So we kind of needed to amuse ourselves to relieve the boredom and tedium of, you know, the daily grind of maths and physics, etc.
That's right. Although I did used to really like maths, actually. I passed a point where I really enjoyed it. And I can remember the teacher saying, and I can't remember what, I'm ashamed to say, I can't remember what her name was, but she was fantastic. And she said that I would use O-level maths every day of my life, and pretty well, she's been spot on. I have. So it's a very useful thing to have a basic grounding in.
My A-level maths, like zero.
Yeah, same.
Forget it.
Same. As soon as we pass that point, it becomes more theoretical, doesn't it? It becomes something that is just something
intangible.
Completely different. Yeah. O-level maths is practical. It's useful. You know, you need to work out how much paint you need to paint your bedroom. O-level maths, there you go. Thank you very much. A-level, not so much. We both dropped out, actually, didn't we? Of both. No, actually, I didn't drop out of maths. I wanted to. They let me drop out of physics. They wouldn't let me drop out of maths. And I failed, as predicted. And I was very cross about it. You, I think, did drop out of it.
No, I also carried on and failed.
Did you drop out of physics?
No, I carried on and I also failed. So from being kind of model students at the O-level stage, we didn't fare so well in those subjects. But I think actually in hindsight, we're both more creative people.
That's right.
And we were probably more suited to a different kind of study paths. But do you remember there was this kind of aptitude test?
I remember that.
That we were all given.
No.
And it was like whether you'd be suited to be a librarian or an engineer. And so it was based on that I thought, yes, I should pursue the sciences, which didn't work out so well.
We both went and did our work experience at the same engineering firm, didn't we?
We did. Do you remember that? Where all the boys got put in the lab and we got put in with the secretaries and we were furious.
That's right.
We were young feminists, even at that age, before we knew what feminism was, I think.
That's right. Oh, gosh, I do remember that aptitude test now. And I remember, so embarrassing. It makes me cringe now. But it caused massive hilarity for my mum and stepdad. I'd had a conversation with the careers advisor because I think solicitor came up as something that might be a potential career progression. And so I'd been talking to the careers advisor about a career in soliciting. So I went home and told my mum about this. And of course, they were just in hysterics. And of course, I got all cross and sulky because they were laughing at me. And they're like, well, what are you laughing about? So they had to explain that soliciting is not quite the same as solicitoring. And they didn't know how the careers advisor had managed to keep a straight face.
I've never heard that story. That is really funny.
Needless to say, that wasn't my chosen career path, either one of the two. But it's a funny story to tell that makes me cringe.
I think actually you would have been a good solicitor because you're really a person who loves to get into the details of things and you really like to understand things, make sure it makes really good sense. So
that's true. Possibly.
So perhaps a career in law would have been an excellent choice for you. But here we are.
Who knows?
You see the podcaster.
That's right, doing very different things. Well, another not unique, because we've had all sorts of people on the podcast, but we're not here to talk about a keto story, although dietary choices do kind of come into it as a bit of part of the story. But really, this is a very different story, but one that we have been discussing you sharing for a while. But I pressed you again about it the other day because we had a post in my Facebook group that went down very well and was helping a lot of people. And a lot of people, things were starting to dawn on them that this was quite possibly something that was severely impacting their lives. So the time seemed right to share the story and help some more people perhaps start to get to grips with this. So instead of me rambling on, I think it's probably better that you introduce what we're going to be talking about. It's your story.
I think you sharing my story in one of your Facebook groups and me seeing how it resonated with, you know, a number of people really encouraged me to share what happened really to me. Because helping other people is, you know, a wonderful thing to do when you have knowledge of something that's transformed your life. Mm. I suffered with chronic pain and chronic fatigue for around 18 years. It started after I'd had what's known as a whiplash injury. I'd been racing a go-kart, spun off the track and went headfirst into a barrier. The next day I woke up and I was concussed. I felt sick. I was like, oh gosh, this feel awful. Went to the hospital and the doctor, I had this terrible like pain in my neck, awful headache. And he said, oh, you've torn a ligament in your neck. It's a whiplash injury. Nothing we can do for you. You know, go home and rest. And so I really thought that, oh, okay, I'll be fine in a few weeks, but, you know, in a few days. Then after a few weeks, I still had this terrible neck pain. And my brother recommended seeing an osteopath. So I go to the osteopath and, you know, he's a lovely man, gives me a nice relaxing massage, a few clicks and cracks. And I think, oh, okay, this is really going to help me. But pain would always come back. And before I knew it, I was going every week, sometimes twice a week. I was taking like the maximum doses of ibuprofen and codeine. It's like a combination tablet you could get. And on top of this like searing like neck pain that kind of radiated down my kind of neck, shoulder and back, I started having headaches every single day and a migraine at least once a week. But, you know, I'm the kind of person who just, you know, pushes on and pushes through. So
you had quite a full-on job, didn't you?
Yeah, it was very deadline-driven business that I was in. And, you know, I was very conscientious. So I would get a little exercise mat, unroll it in the stockroom that had no windows. So I'd notice a migraine come on. I'd go, okay, I'm going to the stockroom, go and lie down, you know, take more tablets. When, you know, the worst of it was over, I'd come back out into the office, crack on with more work. This kind of went on and I started seeing a chiropractor, I tried a physiotherapist, I tried acupuncture, I went to yoga, meditation, I tried Tai Chi, I was then, you know, having like a massage, you know, once or twice a week, and I wasn't getting better. I seemed to be getting worse. And it was costing me a fortune in all these treatments. And not only that, it was like I needed a special pillow. Then I needed a special mattress, a different office chair, a headset instead of a handset, like flat shoes only. It was like I was trying all these things, even these like weird and wonderful exercises where I was like suspending heavy weights off the back of my neck because I'd been told my neck was too straight. Another person said my lower back was too curved. I had one foot longer than the other. My feet were flat. All these different reasons why I was in pain. I would never get out of pain unless I, you know, was constantly being manipulated, cracked, crunched, massaged by these various people who were all very nice, kind, well-meaning people, who seemed very, like, genuinely wanted to help based on the knowledge that they'd acquired. But it was just getting to a point where my life was so miserable because every day I was in pain and I just couldn't get it to stop. And then when I thought it couldn't get any worse, it did. Suddenly, it just came over me like a brain fog of like a lack of being able to concentrate. Like my memory was shot, and I'd always been somebody with an excellent memory. Even like the ability to cross a road suddenly became an impossible task. By the time I'd looked left, you know, basically seen what car was coming, by the time I'd looked right, I couldn't remember what I'd seen when I'd looked left. And so very worried at this point, I went to the doctor who diagnosed me with stress that I needed to take. He signed me off of work for 8 weeks and gave me something called amitriptyline at a low dose, which you might be familiar with. It's a mild antidepressant, but in a very low dose, it's used to treat chronic pain.
What is it, like an SSRI or a different family?
I can't remember exactly now. You need to look that up. But after these 8 weeks and, you know, taking the tablets, I returned to work, but only 4 days a week. I kind of managed my life working 4 days a week really hard. And then one day, usually a Friday, I'd take off, but have complete bed rest in order to recuperate and then function like a normal human being on the weekend. But even then, it was like I was still needing to kind of really sleep a lot. Like I'd come home from work, go straight to bed, sleep like solid 12 hours, then get up and go again. So increasing amounts of sleep were kind of necessary. And at that point, I didn't really put it down to, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome. I just felt really tired. This kind of goes on for 18 months, this 4 days a week situation. A great opportunity to make more money comes up in the business. So I'm like, yeah, I'm up for it. Let's do it. Go back to full time. And after 9 months, I crashed again. I just think, okay, I need to take 8 weeks off again and then I'll bounce back like I did before. But after 3 months, I was no better. My husband really started to worry that I was, you know, how ill I was. So at that point, we decided that we would leave living in central London and move to the south of Spain because more daylight, more sunshine, more greenery, you know, fresh air and nature, it's healing. And that all sounds wonderful. But as you know, moving to another country is not without its own unique stresses.
Right. Well, moving for one, and then you add on a different country. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So we moved to this lovely place. First few weeks, I'm out walking every day. My headaches and migraines, like, disappear. I'm thinking, yes, this is wonderful. But I've got this, like, ache in my back. I go to see a local like physiotherapist who does this adjustment on me. And as I'm leaving his office, I suddenly start to feel very weird, and I get in my car, and on the way home, I start shaking. And I'm like, this is very unusual. And the pain comes on. And by the time I get home, I'm in searing pain, total agony. I take some ibuprofen. I think, right, I'm just going to go to bed. Tomorrow I'll feel better. The next day, I felt exactly the same. And this situation continued for over a year of being in extreme pain. I couldn't sit. I couldn't lie down. It was constant. I go to the doctor here and have an MRI scan. It comes back and they say, there's nothing wrong with your back. You're just stressed. Go home, relax, sit in the garden. And I'm like, what do you mean there's nothing wrong with me? There's clearly something very wrong with me. Like, stress cannot be making me feel this much pain. Like, I was mad. I was so angry. I was like, felt like they hadn't seen me. Like, I'd just been ignored. So I went home. I just felt helpless because nobody knew what was wrong with me. I had this awful pain. I didn't want to go back and see another chiropractor or physiotherapist. I was like, oh no, I can't. I just like, no. So I then tried all the painkillers and they just didn't work. It was like I would feel horribly like out of my head. High in a very unpleasant way, but the pain was still there. And then it was like the only thing that would kill the pain was like alcohol, like wine. But then I noticed, I was like clock watching, but it was like, is it 12 o'clock yet? Is it an acceptable time to have some wine? And I was like, this is not heading in a good direction. Like, you need to knock the wine on the head. I can see that this is, you know, not going to be the solution to the problem. So I found a really nice lady who did massage, and I just started to have massages with her once a week. And I don't really know what happened, but just over time, over the next 2 years, I just gradually got better. Better to the point that I had no pain. I could even wear high heels again. And it was like, oh, finally, I've been through an ordeal. I've got my life back. And then my dad died very suddenly, unexpectedly. And so at this point, I moved back to the UK to sort out all my dad's unfinished business projects, which were a bit of a mess. Most of my parents' money were tied up in this one big unfinished project, building project.
Oh, I remember. I remember.
And so I said, right, I'm going to get this project finished. And then, you know, when it's done, my mum will have a home to live in, an income. She'll be safe. It was like, it was really felt like a really important thing to do. And it was a pretty big project to take on for somebody who had fairly minimal experience in building. And then on top of it, the financial crash happened. So banks were calling in loans, property prices were falling. It added on another layer of pressure, which was, you know, super scary. And on top of this, my two brothers are like constantly arguing. It was just so much family drama. And as much as we all love our mothers, working with our mother every single day for 18 months, I think would be challenging to most of us. So yeah, it was a challenging situation. So it took me 18 months to complete the project. And during that time, the headaches come back, the migraines come back. The pain is fine. I mean, I'm doing quite a lot of like walking in my spare time. I was like trying to like do one of those moonwalk things. I think it's like a half marathon distance. So I was getting out, moving my body. I was having massages every week. I just could feel I was getting ill again. But the most important thing to me was making sure that my mum was going to be okay. And I committed to this project. I had to see it through to the end. I couldn't abandon it. That's how it felt to me, at least. So I pushed through and I pushed through. And, you know, I went back to the 4 days a week with one day of bed rest, thinking when I get to the end of this and I get back to Spain, I'll be able to bounce back like I did before. That's what I hoped would happen. But by the time I left the UK, having completed the project, feeling very guilty about leaving my mum on her own to take care of the final details and look after other aspects of the family business, the minute our car touched down in France on the drive back to Spain, I suddenly got this terrible neck spasm. And when I got home, it was still killing me. And I was like, okay, I'm going to need to find an osteopath, a chiropractor, somebody. So I find this guy, have some treatments. It's no better. I try another guy. It's no better. And at this point, it's really like the pain just starts spreading to the whole of my body. And I just keep thinking, oh, if I can just avoid the stress, I'll get better. And I just was, you know, still, although in another country, still speaking to my mum every day, still absorbing all the stresses of what was going back, still feeling very guilty for not being there, but, you know, very torn because my husband, you know, hated being in the UK. I hated being in the UK. But, you know, what my mum needed from me seemed to be the most pressing thing in my life. My health just really declined seriously at this point. I started taking naps in the day because the fatigue was really bad. And my husband was having to do, you know, the shopping, the cooking, the washing, work a full day, trying to reestablish himself, you know, career again in a foreign country, not easy. And nobody knew what was wrong with me. I just kept thinking, okay, I will get better. I can get better, but I didn't. So I start investigating different ways of eating to see if that's going to help. So I switched to a vegan diet and yeah, I start to feel a bit healthier in general. That's because I was just eating crap before, but it's not enough to cure me of this debilitating pain and like needing to take, you know, regular naps. I then hear about a course in London called the Lightning Process. And I go to take this course, but I'm like really worried, like, hey, how am I going to stay awake for like more than 3 hours at a time? How am I going to be able to sit in a chair for that long? Like, will I be allowed to like lie on the floor if I need to? This is kind of like where I'm at. I can, you know, get myself to London. It's a bit of a challenge, but, you know, if this is going to heal me, I'm going to do it.
And so what was the course? Why did it attract you?
A friend who had recovered from ME recommended it. Right. And at this point, I'd started to realise that probably what was wrong with me was ME, which is also known as fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's pain, which kind of spreads all over the body. You know, it can be in certain parts, but it can affect the whole of the body, and fatigue that doesn't get better after rest.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because there are these different terms that fly about: fibromyalgia, chronic pain, chronic fatigue syndrome, ME. You know, are they all basically the same family, the same sort of thing with slight differences? How does that work? You know, why do you get a diagnosis of one versus another, if you get a diagnosis?
Yeah, some people it might just be chronic pain for them. Other people, it might just be the fatigue, but without any pain. And then you get people who have the pain and the fatigue, and that would generally be called fibromyalgia.
Right.
So fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome are the most recent terms. It used to be called ME. And really, it's a syndrome. It's not a specified disease. It's a collection of symptoms that people...
That's why it's so difficult, isn't it, to pin it down and say this is what you've got. It's more a case of ending up there after eliminating other things and figuring out, well, this, you kind of probably come under this umbrella, but it's not like saying, oh yeah, you've broken your leg.
Exactly that. It's actually a diagnosis by exclusion. It's kind of how they exhaust all the other options, and then when there's no options, they just pop you into this diagnosis. So people do experience different kind of symptoms and different levels of it.
So you hadn't actually had any kind of diagnosis at this point. You had just heard somebody else talk about it and thought that sounded a bit like you?
Yeah, a friend of my husband's, he'd had it. He recommended this course, but it was like, I think just in searching online, I'd read about it when I first came to Spain, but I wasn't prepared to accept that was what I had. And the reason is because they said there was no cure.
Right.
And at the time, I couldn't accept that I would always have this illness. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I was like, okay, this is sounding like exactly what I have. And I still don't accept that there is no cure. I'm going to try this course. And so I tried the course, which is, you know, was really helpful. And I did start to feel a bit better. It uses a lot of like NLP techniques.
Mm-hmm. Neuro-linguistic programming.
Programming, yes, exactly. So yeah, like my life at this point is I'm pretty much housebound, bed, sofa. If I rest all week, I might be able to manage a couple of hours out, you know, maybe go for lunch on a Saturday with my husband, or we'd go to the supermarket together. Like, that's the extent of my life. Like, I can't work. Like, walking's too painful. Can't carry a handbag. It's just too painful. The pain is unreal. And so I go in this course in London and I start to feel better, but not completely better. So at this point, I'm looking at the specialist ME clinic in London that I've heard about, and I book an appointment and I go there. They tell me to scratch the vegan diet. I should switch to a more of a paleo approach, sugar-free, gluten-free.
And just to clarify, I can't remember what ME actually stands for, even though it's a sort of an outdated term now.
Oh, it's something that's very difficult to remember even for me.
Do we need to ask my best friend Google?
Yeah, we do.
Let's see what he says. I don't know why I think of Google as being male. What does ME stand for, Mr. Google?
Google's definitely a lady, because ladies know everything.
Well, yeah, that's a very good point. Oh, here we are. Blimey, yes, this is obviously why they changed the name. ME stands for myalgic
encephalitis.
I'm trying to get all the syllables. Encephalomyelitis. I'm never going to be able to say that properly, but it starts off with saying chronic fatigue syndrome, which is what they've decided to call it now, which I think is eminently sensible.
Agreed.
I mistakenly thought ME stood for something fairly simple. Nope.
Nope, definitely not. Now you know. So this clinic in London, they tell me to switch to a more paleo way of eating, that I need more protein, and they give me, you know, a list of 10 supplements I need to start taking. And so I take this approach, like I'm now on the lookout for what food might be causing this pain. It's going to be something in my diet, I feel quite convinced.
And you are used to trying out new diets I think both of us, since we were that sort of age, 13, 14, that's certainly when I did my first diet and started losing weight. We've tried
the era of the lean cuisine meal.
Oh, lean cuisine. Yeah, I didn't get too into lean cuisine, but it was Herbalife for me, and then tried all sorts of ridiculous diets, the grapefruit diet and all sorts of
things. Oh, yeah, so many eggs.
All sorts of things, actually. You know, the eggs and the steak were actually a brilliant part of it. But the grapefruit juice, which I had to hold my nose and swallow because I couldn't eat grapefruit, which completely takes away the whole point of it. But the point is that you were no stranger to trying all sorts of different diets from a weight loss perspective. So it's kind of a natural thing to think maybe, well, you know, maybe there's something in this for me, for this problem.
Yeah, isn't there some philosopher who talks about, you know, food being our medicine?
That's right.
So it's like quite natural to think, okay, if I clean up my diet, eat the right things, take these supplements, my body's going to recover, reset. So I commit to taking all of these supplements, and then, you know, I have my kind of regular check-ins with this nutritional therapist, and it's like, are you feeling better or are you feeling worse? And every morning, my husband says, how do you feel today? And I'm thinking, right, okay, body scan, how am I feeling? Am I feeling better or am I feeling worse? And this kind of symptom checking every single day, even like after every supplement, you're like, is this working? I'm taking so many. Like, how am I meant to know what's working and what isn't? It was just like so confusing. But I started to become like really afraid. Like if I went out to a restaurant and there was some really delicious looking bread and I ate a piece, I'd then be like really stressed thinking, oh no, the gluten's could be what's causing my pain. Am I going to be in pain tomorrow? And I think all the stress just made me really tense. I became quite paranoid about food, and I'd never been somebody who'd ever really thought about food being an enemy. I'd never had any kind of eating disorder issues.
No, we've always kind of, we've looked to control it, but we've both always liked food.
Yeah.
And I can remember your fridge comes to mind when we'd had a night out. Your mum was great at stocking the fridge with M&S food. And we used to come in after a Saturday night out and raid the fridge, which was always super loaded, and have crazy things that teenagers shouldn't have been allowed to cook themselves, like a nice bit of fillet steak and something else. Do you remember? We used to cook up the most delicious, gourmet foods out of your fridge. So we've always enjoyed food. We've tried to try and control it. So to lose that love.
The non-gourmet food, like Finder's crispy pancakes.
Oh, completely. Oh, absolutely. We were not food snobs, were we?
Yeah, even though I think a bird's eye potato waffle might have passed our lips on a few occasions.
Bird's eye potato waffle, they're waffling versatile. Finder's crispy pancakes, they were my favourite. That's what your mum always used to make me for my tea when I came round. Cheddar, the cheesy ones. Never the meat ones. They were disgusting. It was the cheesy ones with chips. I mean, yeah, so you can gather we didn't always eat the most wholesome of foods, but
hey,
my point is that we've always
the 80s.
Exactly. We've always both loved food. So
yeah,
to start fearing it is quite a big deal.
Yeah, it was. But you know, I was really desperate to get better and relentless in my pursuit of getting well again. I mean, I had these like this test called a mitochondrial function test. You probably know all about mitochondria, but that came back as suboptimal.
Powerhouse.
So that apparently was the reason for, I had this physical reason for the lack of energy, and I just needed to, you know, get my mitochondria functioning better again, and I would get better, but it just didn't work. And so then I switched on to the next expert, Dr. Myhill, and her book, which again is another, you know, full-on protocol of pills and potions to take. And I was declining. And I was getting desperate at this point. It was like I started praying. I was meditating. I was even chanting. I mean, you know, I've enjoyed a bit of yoga, but I'm not a particularly woo-woo type of person. So for me, I knew I was really throwing everything at it, and I just wasn't getting better. So in my desperation, I decided to go back to the doctor. I thought, surely if I go to another doctor, he might be able to tell me what's going on. He sends me for blood tests, more MRIs. It comes back, oh, we think you might have an autoimmune condition, but we can't really tell you which one it is. Possible autoimmune condition. So I was like, okay, but we've looked at your MRIs and you've got disc degeneration. That's definitely the reason for your pain. And then the doctor helpfully says to me, and you've got this like narrowing of the nerve canal in your back. And, you know, if that gets any smaller, you'll be completely paralyzed.
Helpful.
That puts the fear of God into me.
Yeah, that's not going to stress you out at all.
Yeah, not only do I have this, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia.
Now I'm going to be paralyzed.
That, you know, is incurable. Oh, now I'm imminently going to be paralyzed if I move. So his suggestion was to put me on something called prednisone, which is a steroid for the rest of my life.
Wow.
And the, you know, the side effects of this are increased risk of cancer and weight gain and very mood risky. Swings. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, I can't believe that this is happening to me. I'm like, yeah, I've been given a diagnosis, but like, holy shit, like, fuck, what am I going to do? It's like, it feels really real and I'm just in despair. But then something about this diagnosis, it didn't make sense to me. So in my 30s, when I'd first gone to the doctor for the MRI scan, and they told me, there's nothing wrong with your back. I'd been in severe pain. And yet, when I went to this next doctor in Spain, in my 40s, he held up my MRI scan and said, you've got all this deterioration between the discs. That's what's causing your pain. And I just thought, that doesn't make logical sense to me. There's got to be another reason. And so at this point, I'm just decided to like have one like real last ditch attempt where I'm going to just throw everything at this. And I do the unthinkable, which is reach out to a stranger, or a kind of somebody I know through a friend of a friend who I'd heard of had recovered from chronic fatigue syndrome. And I'd thought about doing this so many times, but either I was in a state of desperation where I thought, if I speak to this woman, I'm just going to be in floods of tears and sound like a maniac. I'll wait until I feel better. And then feel better, yeah. I think, oh, I might be getting better. I don't need help. So I contacted her. She recommended a Facebook group, which was a group called Recovery, Hope and Help. And just went through all the posts, could see that there were two main, like a couple of like courses that people were recommended, the Lightning Process and another one called Mickle Therapy. And so I start looking into Mickle therapy and I'm like, oh, okay, this sounds really interesting. So Dr. Mickle is from Scotland. I think it might have been his girlfriend who had fibromyalgia. And so he started like really looking into like what the underlying causes could be and gained a bit of a reputation in the local area. So more and more people would start traveling to be seen by him and he became somewhat of an expert on the subject. What he noticed about all the people that he saw was they all seemed to share a very similar personality type, which was they were very nice, conscientious, perfectionistic, people pleasers. And I was like, oh, hold on. Like, I recognize myself in that list. And that most of them had had certain life events, like some it had come on like post virus, but for a lot of people it had come on after a traumatic event or like a grief or some other kind of emotional event in their life. And that a lot of them had chronic stress in the mix as well. So what his theory was that the life event compounded with this personality type meant that your autonomic nervous system had gone into overdrive and that you were suffering from all these different symptoms. So it could be insomnia, could be digestive issues, could be fatigue, dizziness, anxiety. Another one was like frequent urination. And I was like, oh my God, like I need to pee about 10 times an hour. It was this stress peeing thing, which I thought was just a bladder issue that I had on the side. I was like, okay, this is really interesting now. Tell me more, Dr. Mickle. He went on to say that once you start having all these different weird symptoms popping up, and, you know, they're not treated by conventional medicine, you start to think, well, what's wrong with me? Nobody can tell me what's wrong with me. I've got all these symptoms popping up and you start to feel afraid because you don't know what's wrong. And then because you don't know what's wrong and you feel afraid, it keeps your autonomic nervous system in overdrive. And so the symptoms create the anxiety, and the anxiety about the symptoms creates more symptoms. And I thought, oh, okay, this really makes sense to me. There's this basic understanding that you need to gain. And then you have like 8 kind of sessions with a therapist. So his kind of cure for it is stop fearing the symptoms. The antidote to stress isn't always less stress. The antidote to stress is joy, fun, pleasure in your life. And that you have to stop waiting to do the things that you'd like to do once you get better. You have to start doing the things you'd like to do, and that will help you get better. That you have to reduce all the things in your life which, like, I should be doing this and I must be doing that. Basically, just stop putting yourself at the bottom of the list of needs within, you know, within your family. Because, you know, being selfish is seen as a very admirable quality. But when this selflessness gets completely out of balance and your own needs aren't met, it becomes really frustrating. And so the prescription really is to make sure you are taking some time for yourself to meet your own needs.
And actually, if you can still, it's probably not the most sensible twist to put on it, even so, but maybe as a starting point, if you are the kind of person who puts other people's needs first and really struggles to put your own, which by the sounds of it is very likely if these are the kind of issues you have, you could always start, if you just need that little shoehorn in, you can start by thinking about it maybe as, if you do want to be the kind of person who's putting the rest of your family, for example, first, how are you going to be able to do that if you're so ill, you're so debilitated that that family has got to look after you and you're in that kind of spiral? So even if you have to start by still putting your family first, by starting to put yourself first, you are doing that. Because how can you do that? How can you help your family if you can't get out of bed, if you can't lift your head off the pillow in the morning?
Yeah, it's so true. And I think you kind of, you know, while it's all manageable, while you're juggling all the balls or the plates, is it juggling all the plates? Juggling all the balls, I don't know.
You spin plates and you juggle balls.
That's it. Okay, so, you know, while you're juggling all the balls, life is working for you. You can put your needs to the bottom of the pile. Everybody else is happy with you. Everybody else's needs are met. And all you got to do is suffer this pain. This physical pain and fatigue. But when it gets to the point where you can't function, you can't help anybody, that's the tipping point. You're like, well, this clearly isn't working for me. And while I thought, you know, this seems like a strange cure to me, that I need to start attending to my own needs, having fun, like, what's this? This is weird. I so recognized my personality type, and I was so desperate that I thought, you know, what have I got to lose? And I think the last and possibly like the most important part of the work that I did in those 8 sessions was what they taught me was when I felt a symptom flare up, I had to think very specifically about what was happening in my life at that time or just prior to the symptom flare up and label what emotion I was feeling at the time. And that might sound simple, but for me, it was really hard. They literally give you a list of emotions. Like I had this list and I had to go through and thinking, right, what am I feeling? Am I feeling frustration? Am I feeling guilt? Am I feeling anger? Am I feeling sadness? I was so used to being this like jolly person that was always happy that I think it would maybe just become a bit of an act, and that I felt, you know, like, you know, I think we're all taught being angry isn't ladylike.
Mm.
Like forgiving people is not only the kind thing to do, but kind of spiritual, you know, let's forgive everyone. But if you're kind of rushing past this forgiving everybody because it seems like the right thing to do, and you're not actually feeling like, God, they're driving me mad, or like, that's not very fair, or they've really overstepped my boundaries. Like, how dare they treat me like this? You know, I was like, oh, they must be having a bad day. They obviously, you know, need my attention, or, you know, need my help. I shouldn't make their day worse by complaining that they're treating me badly. So in this process of when you feel the symptom, you label the emotion. And I was like, this all sounds a bit mad, but it's actually working. Like, and I mean, there was one time when the lady that I worked with, I had a session with her booked, and I was having terrible pain this day. I was lying in bed. I said to my husband, Steve, Steve, please answer the phone. Tell her that I can't talk today. I'm in too much pain. And to her credit, this woman said, no, take the phone to her, put her on the phone. She needs to talk. And she said to me, this is the problem. She said, you need to talk about your feelings. That's how you're going to get free of the pain. And I'm eternally thankful for what she did that day, because it was an epiphany for me. It really was. And I really started to talk about like stuff that had happened in my life that had been quite painful. So in the process of these 8 sessions, I was consulting with the chronic fatigue recovery page that my friend had recommended. And one day I just saw this post about a book called Healing Back Pain. At the time I thought, oh, I've got this, you know, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia thing going on, but I've also got this whiplash injury, which has never healed. And so I saw them as 2 separate things. So I'm very interested in this post. They recommend this book by a man called Dr. John Sarno. And there's a link to a YouTube clip from a really old like TV show in America called 2020. And this show, I think, might be like late 80s, early 90s. And so they have this woman who's working on the Rosie O'Donnell show.
Yeah.
And Rosie is like so wants to help this lady, because over time she's deteriorated to the point where her ankles hurt so much that she's in a wheelchair, and she's tried everything. And the doctor's like, well, looks like you tried everything. There's nothing more we can do for you. You've got to live with it. So she puts out this plea to the audience and the people at home. Does anybody know anyone who can help this lady on my show?
This is where we end the first part. Make sure to come back next week to find out what happened next. See you then. To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from John Pierpont Morgan. The first step towards getting somewhere is to decide that you are not going to stay where you are. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.